this magnet. Now what I do is I lift it, I energize the coil without the magnet, and say it was 20 milliamperes. When I have the magnet, the permanent magnet, on the other side of the lever, now there's extra weight, I need 30 milliamps to hold it up, the difference being the 10 milliamps. And I was trying to equate that to the magnetic field properties of the magnet. That's basically it. It's really a very simple experiment.
Okay, you're giving me more information. I'm slowly getting the picture, but there's still a lot of missing ingredients. The lever arm is 1 inch beyond the pivot on one side, and I think a magnet is connected there. There is no magnet on the 10-inch side, and the solenoid is holding that one up. There's a lot of ambiguity there. Holding it up means that the lever arm is made out of a ferrous material, and it's being sucked into and making contact with an electrified solenoid magnet, electromagnet. Is it being sucked up to it, or is it being repulsed from it? So is it the holding force so that the lever arm doesn't break away from the solenoid electromagnet? Is that what the current is doing? Over to you, John.
Okay, the solenoid coil is bolted to the table with a little rod that goes up to the lever. When I energize that solenoid coil, the plunger pulls down, pulls on the 10-inch side of the lever, and holds the magnet up. Is that a little better?
Okay. So, it's a real solenoid.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Right. So, if I get the picture correctly, the solenoid electromagnet is a mechanism that has its built-in limits as to how far it can be deflected. In other words, the solenoid cannot be pulled out all the way from the coil. There's something limiting it. That rod coming out of that goes up to your 10-inch long lever arm. It's got some kind of a natural position. You electrify the electromagnet. It pulls its armature inside of that coil. It pulls on the rod and pulls your lever down. And I think you're saying now that you do that operation with and without the magnet on the 1-inch side, and there's only one magnet so far, so you're just suspending the weight of that second magnet by way of current flowing into the electromagnet, sucking its coil in. Is that what you're saying, John? Go ahead.
That is correct, and the difference in load is 10 milliamps.
A difference in load of 10 milliamps. 10 milliamps of current is required to hold it at some particular position. If I put in 5 milliamps, what happens? It doesn't get sucked in at all, or it holds in at some other position. Over to you, John.
At 5 milliamps, it will fall. It will fall right to the magnet. The permanent magnet will fall directly onto the table.
Okay. If you put in 10 milliamps, it holds it at a given position. What happens if you put in 15 milliamps?
It will go higher, but now I'll wind up getting to the full extent of the solenoid and wind up bottoming it out, and you don't want to do that.
Okay. More current into the solenoid makes it push its armature out. That's a pusher-type solenoid, not a suck-in type. Go ahead.
No, it's a suck-in type. More current I put in there, the deeper the solenoid plunger will go into the coil.
Is the solenoid above the lever arm or below the lever arm? That hasn't been told to me yet.
It is below. It is bolted to the table.
Okay. More current makes it pull up higher, but it's pulling downward. That sounds very confusing. Go ahead.
It pulls the lever down, the 10-inch side of the fulcrum, and that causes the right-hand side of the fulcrum to go up.
Okay, so when you talked about the lever arm going up, you were talking about the 1-inch side, even though previously you were talking about the 10-inch side, and you didn't tell me you were switching sides. You can see the problems I'm having here. Okay, so 10 milliamps of current or 30 milliamps of current allows it to hold the magnet on the one inside at a particular altitude. And then I think you're about to add the second magnet. Go ahead with the rest of the experiment, John.
No, basically that's it. An additional 10 milliamps is required to hold the magnet at a specific height. And that's the energy I was looking to associate with the strength of the magnetic field.
Okay, you've got a magnet on the one inside that's being lifted or not lifted as much by the movement of this lever. The lever is being moved downward by the suck-in of a solenoid, an electromagnet solenoid. If I put a weight on the right-hand side, the one inside, where the magnet is located, if I put a weight there that's equal to the weight of the magnet, and you're telling me there's only one signal magnet on the one inside, and it's not operating against any other magnet, is what you've told me up till now, if I put a weight on the one inside equal to the weight of the magnet, would anything change?
No, if we removed the permanent magnet and put a weight of equal size and equal weight, well, equal weight, it would be exactly the same.
Okay. On the one inside, you're holding up a horseshoe magnet. Is there anything else in the vicinity of that horseshoe magnet, or is it just operating in air on the one inside? Go ahead.
It's hanging in air on the arm on a wooden workbench, so there's nothing anywhere near it.
Okay, if I can take the magnet on the one inside, remove it and put a mass of equal mass, and the operation of the system doesn't change one iota, and the new mass I put in there is not a magnet, I'm having a little trouble understanding why the operation of the electromagnet is giving any kind of evidence of magnetic characteristics of the horseshoe magnet. If I can substitute a non-magnetic mass of equal value and I get the same results, I think it tells me so far that this mechanism is not giving me very much information about the magnetic characteristics of the horseshoe magnet on the one inside. Over to you, John.
Dick, you're 100% right. It could be a simple weight. I was just looking at the difference between the energy the coil needs to operate and then the energy it needs to maintain that weight up. And I was going to relate that to the magnetic field properties of the track test.
Okay, I think I see where you're going now. So in a later experiment, the magnet on the one inside is going to be operating against a second horseshoe magnet on the table. Is that true?
That's correct. It will be removed from this balance scale and put on the track, and then it will maintain a gap of 3 inches. And that's how I was trying to relate the additional 10 milliamps required to hold it at a specific height, or actually any height, compared to its 3 inches when it's opposing another magnet pole to pole.
Yep, I think I see the nature of the question. If I was using a spring scale on the 10-inch side of the lever and pulling down on that spring scale, would that allow me to measure the forces required to do whatever I'm doing with the horseshoe magnets? Over to you, John.
Yes, sir. If we maintain the proper current in the solenoid coil and you put a spring scale pulled down on the 1-inch, you would get exactly what the magnet weighs. You're correct.
I was going to go the other way around. I want to put the spring scale on the 10-inch side. In other words, instead of using a solenoid magnet to apply the force of pulling on the 10-inch lever arm, if I connect a spring scale there and measure forces required with the spring scale, could I get useful data out of that, in your opinion, John? Go ahead.
All we would measure is one-tenth of the weight of the magnet because of the mechanical advantage of the arm.
Agreed. But then as I add the second horseshoe magnet on the one inside, and I re-measure equal positions and measure forces with the spring scale, that, except for the friction of the mechanisms, would that tell me how much force of repulsion or attraction I'm getting out of pairs of horseshoe magnets? Over to you, John.
That's an excellent question, Dick. We could measure the attraction force, because the spring scale on the one side, we would be pulling down to make that weight. We could probably do that, yes.
I could also attach a spring scale on the 10-inch side, pulling upward when the two magnets are repelling each other. And I could measure now force requirement on the spring scale on the 10-inch side of the lever versus position of the lever. I could measure all those forces versus different distances. Over to you, John.
Link active.
You're absolutely right. Now, that baits the question. When the two magnets are opposing each other, they weigh approximately 10 pounds apiece. The magnetic field of each magnet is opposing at a 5-pound rate. Is that what you're saying?
Okay, I think you told me that each individual horseshoe magnet is 10 pounds. And when I've got one of them suspended all by itself on the 1-inch lever arm, and the second horseshoe magnet is not present, a certain amount of force is required on the 10-inch arm, either upward or downward, and we can account for that, call it positive or negative force, and a spring scale can measure that for us. Now I add the second magnet in the vicinity of the one on the 1-inch arm, and now I start re-measuring forces required for certain separation distances. I can therefore, after I account for the weight, I can now measure very exactly, I think, with that spring scale, I can measure the amount of repulsive force of the magnets and just take whatever answer I get and multiply from the spring scale, multiply by 10, and I know what's going on the 1-inch side. Does that sound like it makes some sense, John? Go ahead.
Absolutely, Dick. What I was trying to do is trying to find out how much energy the magnets are dissipating, or magnetic field potential, whatever you want to call it, to keep them apart at that 3-inch gap. And I want to know why it doesn't decrease. What is the magic? That's what I'm looking into. I know it seems to be a very simple question, and I'm taking some beating on the radio through the week over this question, but I knew you would be able to get me more on track, and maybe there's something more I can do to figure this out.
In my opinion, the spring scale pulling up and pushing down, pulling up or pulling down on the 10-inch lever side is a method of measuring forces and energy that in my mind is a lot closer, a lot more traceable to the Bureau of Standards. To use an electromagnet to do that is a hell of a lot more complicated, because the electromagnet has a peculiar characteristic of force versus current versus position of its armature. I can put a constant current into a solenoid, and I'll get different amount of forces for different positions of its solenoid. I could do a spring scale test and measure position of the solenoid with various amounts of current, and depending on how close the solenoid is to the center of its coil or off to one side of the coil, I'll get a very complicated force versus position versus current relationship. Much more complicated and harder to deal with. A spring scale pulling up or pulling down on the 10-inch side of the lever arm and measuring positions. In other words, as I pulled up on the spring scale in order to push the two magnets closer together, let me drop.
KC2QAQ with a comment, Dick.
Yeah, let me finish this thought first. For each millimeter of movement upward of the lever arm on the 10-inch side, measured with a spring scale and measured with a ruler, for each millimeter of movement, as I'm pushing those two magnets together, I'm going to measure a certain amount of force for that particular millimeter of motion. and the next millimeter of motion is a different amount of force. So I can account for, I can in theory draw myself dot by dot a beautiful curve of force versus distance as I push the two together. Since I know the instantaneous force for each of those positions and the amount of motion between the positions, I now know in a piecewise manner total energy I have put into the system during the time I was pushing the two together. I now know how many ergs or how many joules of energy I put into it because I've measured each millimeter of motion and each individual force in pounds or grams, whatever units you like. And you put, you multiply that all together, it becomes foot-pounds, which becomes joules of energy. Then as I release it and they start going back down, I again measure the forces versus distance, and I can measure the energy with them coming back apart. And except for frictional losses, if you do that experiment carefully and slowly, it is my prediction that you'll get the exact same amount of energy going in as coming back out, except for frictional losses. And whether or not you push the two magnets together with 5 pounds of force and hold them there for 1 second or 1 year, except for the extremely slow degaussing of normal magnets living in the real world, except for that extreme amount of slowly degaussing, a second later or a year later, I think there'll be the exact same amount of repulsive force. That's a guess on my part, John. Over to you, John, and then we're going to pass it over to Glenn next. John?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
John first. Go ahead, John. K2LIW.
Well, I want to thank you, Dick, for spending all of this time. And that's a good procedure. I could try that. The only thing I'm trying to do is try to find out why the magnets do not lose that magic power they have over anything I can measure. As I said, one operation was 10,080 times, and right back up to that vernier height gauge, exactly on the mark. I've spoken to Glenn about this, too. Maybe he has some more input, but I want to really thank you for being so patient with me tonight, and maybe Wesley might want to say something also.
Yeah, let's let Glenn go first, and doing it with a spring scale is a heck of a lot more traceable to the bureau. Because an electromagnet, solenoid-type electromagnet, has got this very complicated factor of each individual position gives you a slightly different force for the exact same number of milliamps. It's a rather nonlinear device. Nonlinear meaning that it doesn't follow a straight line curve. Linear in that it is repeatable in its characteristics, but it's got this crazy curve that's going to be very hard to live with. Therefore, the spring scale, I think, is a more pure experiment. That's a guess on my part. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I think you're on mark with this one, Dick. See, right now, except the only thing is on my spring scale, the units that I would use for the scaling, because when you want to do the mathematical conversions later, I would use Newton meters for the units, and that's when you use the two magnets together, and then you want to see the repulsive force in Newton meters that they're pushing apart at different distances. So as you draw those magnets closer and closer together, they'll be repelling more, and then just make a chart of Newton meters versus distance between two similar magnets. Let me let it drop for a second. Then a second measurement can be made using an electromagnet. In other words, now at this point in time, you can take a piece of iron with a lot of low-loss copper around the outside, and you're going to basically back it up against that other fixed magnet and squeeze them together again at one of the distances where you have a known Newton meter measurement of force, and apply a voltage to that electromagnet to make a similar force, and then basically record the voltage at which you're doing and the current at that point. Then what you can do then is move the electromagnet away from anything around the outside and take a quiescent current difference. And then from that point in time, you can calculate the energy in the electromagnet and the electromagnetic force and then compare it to the force that you measured in Newton meters. And they should come out very, very similar. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I see some real problems with that experiment as you described it, Glenn. I'm not saying you can't do it, but I can see a number of degrees of difficulty. First of all, using the spring scale in the 10-inch side of the fulcrum and measuring each millimeter of deflection and each gram of force or Newton of force, but grams are perfectly acceptable, a gram scale. But to convert from ounces or pounds to grams is easy. To convert from inches to millimeters to thousandths of an inch is easy. So the unit conversion...
I can simplify this. That's why I was saying I've done this before.
And when he goes to his local hardware store, if they only have a swing scale that's rated in ounces and not in...
Scientific American, you can get newton meter scale.
You can measure newtons. How do you on one spring scale measure newton meters? Over to you on that one, Glenn.
The unit on the scale.
The scale measures force. Force is measured in newtons. The scale can also measure distance. The distance can be measured in meters. How does it simultaneously measure newtons and meters and multiply the two together on one simple spring scale? Over to you, Glenn.
I'm sorry, I'm wrong. In other words, it's measuring newtons, and you're going to put the distance between the magnets in meters over the length. But I believe there's also a meter scale or millimeters. So in other words, newton is on one side of the scale, and the distance that you pull the spring scale is in a fraction of meters on the other side. Do you follow, Dick?
Yes. The scale could have a pointer on it, and along the side it could have millimeters or meters of motion of the pointer on the scale, which is operating against the spring. And on the left-hand side, the scale has a certain spring constant. The internal spring has a certain spring constant. Therefore, for each millimeter of deflection, it tells you how many newtons of force are required. So it's giving you an answer in millimeters of deflection, which equals newtons of force. But that's not giving you newton meters directly. You've got to do some other mathematics to get that.
Was saying that, but there's a reason I'm going to go a little bit further with this.
Yeah, but you are going to substitute an electromagnet for the horseshoe magnet on the right-hand side. For you to make sure that the total air gap and magnetic field gap, magnetic field length, and mu of materials is identical between your electromagnet and your horseshoe magnet, to make those things act identically, so that now by putting a known amount of current through the coil of your horseshoe-shaped electromagnet to make it equal the magnetic field that was created by the steady-state magnet, that is an extremely difficult thing to make it track. I don't think you can do that because the coercive forces and the mu of the material that's in the horseshoe magnet is an extremely different material than you're going to put into your horseshoe-shaped electromagnet. I don't think you can make them track. Therefore, the results, you're going to get a result, you're going to make a measurement. To relate it back to what the steady-state horseshoe magnet was doing, I see some problems. Over to you, Glenn.
I don't think that you have to worry about the materials, because right now, the losses, first of all, let's talk about losses for a minute. Eddy current loss, because these are going to be in fixed positions when these measurements are made, there's no eddy currents because they're fixed. So, in other words, and hysteresis loss, there's no hysteresis loss because, here again, it's fixed. In other words, you have to swing the flux to get those kinds of losses. So, those are already out of the equation. Now, the only other thing left is coupling loss between the two. So, in other words, when you're looking at the measurements of current load around the electromagnet against the other, there's the amount of current that you're going to put into it. So, when you locate the electromagnet against the fixed magnet, there's going to be amount of energy in that coil. Now, if you move that electromagnet away from the other magnet and put it in some area to get a quiescent current measurement, and then now you have the difference of energy, the only real difference that you should have is the resistance inside the winding. Because the reason why the magnetic field, it doesn't matter that the shapes are even different, it's the coupling of forces that I believe that you're really looking for here as you bring the two magnets together, because it's when those forces in fixed position intersect each other, that's what's going to cause the current to flow in the electromagnet, to follow what I'm saying, Vic.
Of all the people who sign into the TechNet, Glenn, you're the guy I know with the greatest amount of knowledge about magnets, transformers, and similar things. When it comes to the magnetic portion of electrical engineering, of the guys assigned to the TechNet, you're one of the most best-informed guys I know of. That's good news. Now I'm going to ask you a somewhat difficult question, and I don't know the answer to this one. I'm making an electromagnet. I've chosen a bar of material. I know the exact cross-sectional area of the material. I know the length of the bar, the cross-sectional area, and I've wound 90 turns of wire around that bar as an electromagnetic coil. And I pick up my Hall effect device, and I put it against the outer face of the bar of magnetic material, where it's now going to measure the strength of the magnetic field of this electromagnet. And if I told you the mu of the material, the cross-sectional area of the material, the length of the material, the number of turns of the wire, and I tell you the current I'm putting into that coil, in that environment, could you predict for me the amount of magnetic field that Hall effect device is about to measure? Over to you, Glenn.
No, the answer is no, but that's not what we're looking for here. We're looking for the change.
Okay. The strength of the magnetic field is going to tell me how much repulsion I'm going to get when I start pushing the magnets together. And that's a major factor in the measurement you're about to make. Yeah, if your whole idea was to measure efficiency of in and out and you don't care about the units, I'm going to sort of give that one to you. But if I'm now trying to relate two experiments, one with a pair of horseshoe magnets and one with a horseshoe magnet and an electromagnet, and I want a degree of similarity and equalness between the two, and I can't even predict the strength of the magnetic field I get out of a simple solenoid electromagnet, and the variables involved, I could start telling you those variables. I could tell you why, under the experiment that I just described, it would be very difficult for you to predict what that Gauss meter is going to measure. So the similarity in the two experiments is going to break down, and I think that's going to be a degree of difficulty. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, see, right now, we don't have to know anything even about magnetism in this one. Let's back it up a minute again. We have a force and a distance between two fixed magnets, and we know what that force is now, and we know what it is at each distance, and we can mark off three or four points on a piece of paper and say, okay, this is the force in newtons at this number of meters or fractions of meters between the electromagnets, and that's now recorded. That's an actual force. We know what it is. It's a fixed force, and we've got fixed distances. Now we're going to replace this one of the magnets with an electromagnet. One electromagnet, we're going to know something about it. It's got some quiescent power. In other words, because basically we have to put a power supply on it and find out at different voltages what the voltage and the current is on that record, what the voltages and the currents are when there's nothing interacting. Now we're going to bring it closer into some of the fixed positions that we had the other electromagnet in and energize the power supply and start looking as we start moving to similar, known to create the same forces again with that same scale, the Newton scale, and those same fixed distances again. We're going to look at the power supply difference in power, and we're going to, because now it's going to start coupling. The field will have a mutual coupling point with the electromagnet, and we can record that power. Now we can look at the difference in power, and we can look at the force. Now we can actually rate the electromagnet in terms of force to volt amperes for a fixed DC quiescent. Do you follow what I'm saying now?
Yes, I do, and I see a problem. As I take my bottom electromagnetic, horseshoe-shaped electromagnet, and I've got my steady-state magnet up above, as I move them at various positions and adjust the current flowing through the coil of the electromagnet, I can force the repulsive forces to be equal to each other. I'm going to give you that one. And I can measure the currents required to do that. But I've got a problem. In the case of the electromagnet, at the bottom of the horseshoe, furthest away from the outer open gaps, as I change the current flowing through the coil, I'm changing the true magnetic field at the center of that horseshoe. And the true magnetic field there is a function of two things. One, how much current is going through the coil, and number two, what's the total magnetic reluctance of the total path, which includes the path through the electromagnetic horseshoe and the path through the fixed magnet above it. So because that double change is taking place, evaluating the two becomes difficult. If I was able to put my Hall effect device into a very tiny hole drilled into the bottom of the U shape of the fixed magnet on the bottom, and I bring the two together, I'm going to see an extremely small change in magnetic field, because that thing has got an extremely high coercivity. But my electromagnet is going to be changing tremendous amounts with various amounts of coil and various amounts of gap setting. So because of the number of variables that are changing simultaneously, it's very difficult to evaluate the comparison between the two. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, Wesley, you can pick it up after this, but Dick, I think it's not going to matter, and this is why I don't believe that. In other words, yes, it's true that the shapes of the fields around the two magnets are going to be completely dissimilar, and I don't believe it matters. And I'll tell you why I don't think it matters. Because the field that's around the outside of the electromagnet and the field that's around the fixed magnet are, yes, they're similar sizes and shapes and whatever it is. But the only place where the energy is going to increase in the electromagnet is the coupled distance between the two. So it should only matter. In other words, the only thing that's going to raise the current in that winding is where those two fields start to mingle. In other words, they have to start crossing each other in order to repel. So when that happens, that's what's going to increase the current in the power supply. So, yes, will those fields, if you went around the outside of both of them, would they be extremely different shapes and everything else? Yeah, they will, but those are not the fields that are increasing the current in the winding. The field that's increasing in the winding are due to the cross-sectional area where those two fields are coming together. Do you follow what I'm saying now? Back to you, Dick, and then pass it, I guess, over to Wesley. KC2QIQ.
I think the main reason you're using an electromagnet is because you want to be able to tune the strength of the magnetic field or the repulsive force versus distance between the two magnetic systems. Why do you want to change the magnetic field magnitude on the electromagnet as opposed to using the fixed or quasi-fixed field of a pair of steady-state magnets? Why do you want to use an electromagnet? Over to you, Glenn.
Actually, I don't, but I'm only doing this for an experiment for John. What I'm trying to basically come up here with John is to, in other words, what he's looking for is what is the electrical equivalent to the electromagnetic force so he can get a better idea of the magnet force. In other words, now he'll have two sets of calculations to work with. One is he can look at the force that basically is set up by the magnetic field in terms of force times the distance in newtons and meters, or fractions of meters. Now you can take that down, that force, and figure out that part of the magnetic equation over there to see what kind of force is being available. But you can also beat it around the bush from the other end, and then it would come up with the electrical equivalent of that electromagnetic field. And when they're all said and done, when you back calculate those forces, you should come out with similar numbers. Because here again, this is not a solenoid with a variable gap. In other words, he's just looking at what's actually happening when those two fields touch each other. QSL?
When I use a pair of steady-state horseshoe magnets and I plot force versus distance as I push them together, I'm going to get a certain curve on the page. If on that exact same page, I go to each one of those spatial differences with an electromagnet as one of the magnets, and I plot the current that's required to do that, I get another curve on that page. Those two curves, one of them is going to be a lot more nonlinear than the other, and the two curves will not track each other. There are two very different curves on that page. What am I going to do with those two curves?
Okay, you not only have current, you're also going to have voltage. It's going to take a voltage at a current when you start bringing those magnets together, and you're going to have an amplitude of power that you're measuring going into that electromagnet, and you can put that power down. Now, to go to the other side, and basically for each distance that you move the two close to each other again, adjust the power supply to get the same exact force that you got with two fixed magnets. Now, what I'm saying is that when you write the power in that equation down in each fixed position, there should be a way to back calculate from one force to the other force and come up with similar units, and they should be able to cross.
Quick comment, Dick?
Yeah, we're missing a point here. If John and Wesley had the resources to make the coil of wire out of superconducting materials that are cryogenically cooled. They have no resistance left in that wiring. For each fixed position of spacing between electromagnet and fixed magnet, a certain amount of current is going to be required to get whatever force you want to generate. At each one of those fixed positions, during the time I'm pouring that amount of current into the cryogenically cooled electromagnet, how much power am I putting into that magnet at that instant?
The reason I'm bringing this up, I before we go way off topic on this one, is that the next thing I was going to suggest is that I can name a couple of very good books on electromagnetism and motors. And today, if you have motors that are not moving, in other words, if you have something that's not rotating and where you have a lot of eddy current losses and you have a lot of hysteresis losses between the magnets and the coils, when you're talking about fixed positions, the efficiencies, Dick, are extremely high in electromotors. If you've ever worked with them before and you look at an electromotive forces, which are where I can show books that where you can calculate electromotive force to directly back to newtons over meters, you can actually do this. And the efficiencies that you'll get between the two relate very, very closely because it's done all the time. People who design motors, ABB, they do electrical lighting, motors, and other things. And these calculations are done every day in labs. I mean, I've seen it done in front of my face. And the numbers are amazingly very, very accurate. You can get voltage, current, power, and calculate directly back to the other. And the shapes of the magnets and the electromagnets are completely different. But where the fields couple together, it's extremely accurate and traceable to the Bureau. As I said, otherwise we wouldn't be able to design high-efficiency motors. When the losses in the motors come in, is in the bearings and in the wire, as you're saying, mainly due to the motion. But when you have fixed position magnets and fixed position coils, to calculate electromotive force back to direct the scale in two magnets, that shouldn't be that difficult to measurement, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Okay, now let me repeat the question. Please answer the question. I've got a cryogenically cooled coil producing a certain amount of magnetic field. I'm putting 30 milliamps through the coil. During one of the fixed positions, I'm sitting there during that particular point of measurement. During that point of measurement, I'm putting 30 milliamps through that coil, and it's cryogenically cooled. How many watts am I putting into that coil during that instant?
Excluding the losses in the wire, there shouldn't be any if there's nothing interfering with the field.
Amen. So 0 watts goes in during that step. I then move them 1 millimeter together closer. I now are required to put in 31 millimeters of current into my cryogenic coil. How many watts am I putting into the coil during that measurement?
Here again, it should be the same.
So at every step, I measure 0 watts. What am I going to do with that data?
That's true, but what's happening is you're applying a power where you can basically go back and look at the losses in the coil. That's what John is looking for. His original question, if you remember what he was saying, you have now answered John's question. In other words, his question is, where is the loss in the magnetic field? And you just answered it, Dick. That's exactly correct. And that's what we want John to learn from this experiment, is that the magnetic field in soft ferrites, cryogenically cooled, it's wire loss and eddy current losses, and the coupling of the magnetic field is not where the loss is taking place because they're not moving, they're static. KC2QIQ.
You only get eddy current losses during a change. When he goes from 30 milliamps on position number one,
be there, absolutely.
When he goes from 30 milliamps to position number one to 31 milliamps of position number two, he has put some extra energy into the system.
Losses?
No, this is cryogenic coils. Cryogenic coils, when he goes from 30 to 31 milliamps, he has put 1/2 Li squared delta magnetic field. He has charged that inductor to a brand new magnetic field. During the transition, he put in some energy. During the steady state of each position, there is no loss except I squared R loss. Do you disagree with that? Are you there, Glenn?
Sorry for delay, Dick, but I couldn't have said it better myself. Back to you, Dick, and I think Wesley has a question now.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, I would love to hear that answer, because that was a really good one, Dick. I love it. Here's the situation. You have two magnets, and one of the magnets has a coil on it. You're like in the middle, 20 winds, 40 winds, whatever you want. Now, when you push one of the magnets, there is a current that is being induced, and actually it could be measured on that particular winding. Now, you don't have to push anything. You just keep them vertically, and you see that within 24 hours of time, that current is going to be flowing over there. There is where you see a free energy. And another experiment that could be added to that is... And also that's the proof that there are no losses, but there is external energy that would be actually produced. But the reason for that is because there is a constant effort to keep the magnets apart because of the changes of the magnetic fields and gravitational field of the Earth. Now, the effect is based off transformation of secondary ferromagnetic ferrous fields useful for free energy manufacturing. Work into this magnetization is defined only by magnetic field which directly forms the flux linkage, in other words, inductive coupling with magnetizable wind. And if we have such an installation, that the installation will consist magnetizable wind with ferromagnetic triplet and secondary ferromagnetic triplet, which is located through aerial or dielectric distance. The spurf magnetic field of the secondary is a field which is in insular only around secondary triplets, if I put it properly. And it does not penetrate inductor windings. And it does not take a part with ferromagnetic system scope interaction. I don't know if you understand that. Back to you.
No, I didn't completely understand that one, Wesley. And I'm trying to go step by step with this particular experiment and understand each step. I'm slowly concluding that the power loss you're going to measure, 98% of it is going to be I squared R loss of the winding due to the resistance of the electromagnet.
You got it wrong. It's going to be power gain, not the power loss. You don't have any power supplies. You have two magnets, and one of the magnets is the same as the first one, but it consists the winding on it. You put an ammeter on it. You put a voltmeter on it. You're going to see there is a current flowing on it. There is no pushing, no movement, no nothing, but you can push, of course, if you want to. Back to you.
So I'm going to back to the track for a second. Faraday's law tells me if I've got a coil of wire connected to a galvanometer, a meter of some kind, a zero center milliammeter, for instance, and I take a bar magnet and I plunge it into that coil. On the way in, I will see the coil deflect to the right, the meter deflect to the right. When I take the bar magnet back out of the coil, I'll see the magnet deflect. I'll see the meter deflect to the left. That's Faraday's law.
Well, if you want to understand that better, go to your email right now from August 16th that I have sent you, Core of Physical Effect Generation.
Okay, but while I'm plunging that bar magnet into that coil, and I'm watching the meter movement, if I stop moving the magnet, Wesley, tell me what the meter does.
They're not moving the magnet at all. The magnet is being moved because of the constant effort to keep the magnets apart. They're in vertical position. That's one of the situation. Of course, you can get into the subject from quite the reverse situation, when the magnets are trying to stick together because it's north to south. That's why I said, if you go to the email of yours, you're going to see the picture of what I was talking about, although this one is in reverse, and you're going to be quickly understanding what I was talking about. Back to you.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, one further statement I'm going to say here. If I put 30 milliamps into that coil...
You don't put any. Dick, you're not putting anything. You just have a coil. That's it. You have two magnets and a coil. You're not putting anything to the coil. Back to you.
Will the coil give me a steady state output current if the magnets are not moving?
If you have a sensitive enough devices to measure, you will see they are still moving, because there is a weight of each one of the magnets, and if the magnets are 20 pounds each one, and there is a winding on one of them, the movement and changes to the magnetic field induce the energy or eddy currents, if you said, in the magnet by itself, that actually cause with the magnetic field to produce a power of 3 in to the magnet, to the winding. Back to you.
Are you saying that the coil around one of the magnets will give me voltage, current, some kind of energy output if no motion between the magnets is taking place? Over to you, Wesley.
In ideal situation, you're right. There is no ideal situation. And the reason for no ideal situation is that, as I said, constant effort of keeping the magnets apart and the changes of the gravitational field and magnetic field of the Earth, which actually is work. Back to you, and to Xia. The indication of that work is the current and the voltage, power, for free. Where is it coming from if you are talking only about the losses and to FGN?
I know that John wants to say some things. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I went a little off my subject. My whole effort involves trying to find out why there is no deterioration of the magnetic field when those two magnets can be spaced 3 inches and held that way indefinitely in my lifetime, basically. That's what I was looking into. Wesley is speaking about the rotation of the gravitational field affecting the magnets producing a current. I believe that's what he's speaking about. But I just wanted to know, let you know what direction I was leaning toward and what I was investigating. That's all. I know it's getting late, so back to Wesley.
Thank you very much. So, see, Dick, if you just look at that email, which is quite a few minutes, you're going to be understanding what I'm talking about, although this example actually is quite reversal. It doesn't matter if we're talking about the magnets repelling themselves or the magnets pushing themselves. The changes in the magnetic field creates the current and the voltage. Back to you.
Okay, if I change the magnetic field or change the spacing, I induce a current or induce a voltage in a winding around one of those magnetic structures. It is my belief that no voltage will be generated if there is no motion or if there is no change in magnetic field. And the Earth's magnetic field is quite a bit smaller than the magnetic field you're talking about. So I'm not convinced that the Earth's magnetic field in this experiment is going to give a lot of energy, but that remains to be seen. When it comes to the energy that's holding those two magnets apart, the magnetic field, the steady state magnetic field, I can tell by what you're saying, John, you feel that it is producing a kind of power or energy. The fact that it continuously creates repulsion. I know it's not a good experiment, a good comparison, but if I had a spring in that location holding two things apart, we usually don't talk about the power or energy created by the spring when it is in a steady state condition, continuously producing a force that holds the two things apart.
Yeah, but Dick, you're talking about something usual. That is usual, whatever you're talking about, a spring, and is said and known. We still do not know where the magnetic power of the magnets comes from and how it rules, although we think we do. That's why all of this speculation is taking place. Back to you.
Yeah, to try to quantify what you believe is the energy of a steady state magnetic field of two magnets opposing each other and pushing apart, to try to make a hypothesis that that represents a continuous generation or dissipation of power or energy. That hypothesis is what I think you're trying to confirm, John, and I think that's a tough one. KC2 at WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You got it exactly right, Dick. That's what I'm trying to confirm. Yeah, I know it's a tough one. Although it seems simple to a lot of people, I just had a question about it. And I don't want to tie up any more of your time, and I really do appreciate you spending all this time with us. So let you and Wesley finish up. I'm going to listen out.
Yeah, I do very much appreciate your generosity, Dick, but for the time that we're talking about and trying to understand, you could have looked at the email that I have sent you, and this is August 16. All of the emails are at the same place, and although this explanation is about the reversal of the situation that I was describing, the mechanism is actually the same. And see, the thing is that you're talking about a steady stage. There is no steady stage. If there used to be steady stage, there would be no electricity. And the mass, the bigger the mass, the bigger the current. We can also state that the simplest free energy device would be the one that is constantly under the changes atmospheric situation, which would be the wind or whatsoever. Because the slightest movement, or let's say 500 pounds or 1,000 pounds magnets, which one of them has a winding on it, is a free energy of significant count. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to have to study them some more. I've got to go to work tomorrow, so I'm going to have to leave you guys. Sorry for you all. Bye-bye for now. Mel, are you still there? Did you hang in there this long? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, sir. Very interesting conversation. I was going to put some words in, but it's kind of late, so I'm just going to say goodnight to all. And those who celebrate the Jewish New Year, Happy New Year to you and your families and many more. Thank you for joining us, and Dick says, all's well. We'll do it again next week. 73, good night. This is K2KEY.
Bye-bye, Mel, Wesley, John, Glenn. And next week, we'll try to find out what Mother Nature is really telling us. 73, you all. This was TechNet number 1314 of the series. Bye-bye for now.
73 is all. Everybody have a good week. KC2QIQ.
Say a few words about it. And to exchange 73 to all of you, and have a good night.
The time is 1 a.m. 70.